You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's September 12th, 1982, in Alaska. We're on the bank of the Kinnick River in the South Central region, about 25 miles north of Anchorage, Alaska's most populous city. That's the thing about Alaska. It's not just the largest state in America, it's the most sparsely populated, which means you can be this close to a big city and yet in the middle of a vast wilderness. The Kinnick River is a broad, shallow stretch of water, in places a mile wide, fed by the ice melt from the massive Kinnick Glacier to the east. Kayakers call the river the silt monster. The silt gathers in sandbars that break the surface, creating fast-flowing channels between them. The horizon is a jagged line of snow-clad mountains, dominated by the looming Pioneer Peak at 6,398 feet. Between the river and the mountains is a blaze of gold, forests of aspen erupting in their fall splendor. The air is crisp and bracing. Winter is on its way, it whispers. It's a remote spot, but not completely inaccessible. You can reach it over land on foot. Alternatively, you can approach it from the river or land a light aircraft on the sand. The view alone rewards the effort. But people don't just come here to admire the scenery. They come to hunt. As the light fades, two men move stealthily along the sandbars jutting out of the inky river, rifles slung over their shoulders. Off-duty police officers John Daly and Audie Holloway have been out here most of the afternoon, though without much luck. They reckon they have one last chance for a kill before the light's gone for good. The two men are hunting moose. They've picked the perfect location, as moose are often found around water. Their timing is good, too. Moose are what are known as crepuscular animals, which means they're active at twilight. So now is precisely the time for a sharp-eyed hunter to spot one. But you have to keep your senses alert. Not just your eyes, but your ears and sense of smell. All have to be attuned to the possible presence of an animal. You're listening for the slightest rustle or a crack of a branch, for an involuntary snort or a contented grunt. And you're looking for a sudden movement. However small, you're in the shadows of the darkening forest. But Daly and Holloway's attention is not drawn by any of these signals. You've spotted something else. A boot lying on the next sandbar. Perhaps it's because they're cops that they decide to investigate. As they get closer, they realize the boot isn't just lying there. It's sticking out of the sand. And then they find what seems to be a discarded jacket, too. Like the veteran hunters they are, the two men smell what they found before they see it. A body, partially decomposed and buried in a shallow grave, although some of the sand covering it has evidently been washed away. It's clear to them, as police officers, that the body's been placed there and buried by someone, which can mean only one thing: murder. Without touching anything, they make a note of the site and return to their camp. At first light, they report their grim discovery to the Alaskan State Troopers in Palmer. Sergeant Roly Port leads a team of troopers to the Kinnick River. Port is a skilled and meticulous investigator. He doesn't allow the crime scene to be disturbed until every inch of it has been photographed. He then supervises the careful sifting of sand taken from the grave as they expose the body. It's a long and laborious process, but it pays off. A shell casing is snagged in the mesh screen. Could this have come from the murder weapon? Seems likely. And if it has, it could turn out to be a vital clue. Under Sergeant Port's watchful eye, the body is carefully removed from its makeshift grave and taken away for autopsy. When the pathologist's preliminary report comes in, the troopers learn that the victim is a female. Her age is difficult to say, given the decomposition of the body. It's estimated that she's been dead for at least 3 months, maybe longer. If she was put there at the end of the last year, the winter temperatures would have preserved the body like it was in a freezer. And so it begins. Another case for the overworked homicide detectives of the Alaska State Troopers. Overworked because this isn't the first body that's been found in the Anchorage area in recent years. Not by a long shot. The question on everyone's mind is, could this latest death be connected to the others? The answer, as they will eventually discover, is yes. As always, a major investigation of this kind is a team effort. Many officers from multiple forces will play a part, but one officer's contribution will prove decisive. At the time this latest Jane Doe is discovered, State Trooper Sergeant Glenn Flothy is busy with 17 other homicide cases. You could say he's got a lot on his plate. For that reason, he's not initially assigned to this investigation, though he watches the progress of the case with interest. His reputation as a formidable detective means it's only a question of time before he's called in to help. Then, he will face the greatest challenge of his career as he leads the hunt for the most prolific serial killer in Alaska's history. My name is Mark Dodson, and welcome to Detectives Don't Sleep. Each week, we'll shadow the world's most remarkable sleuths, real detectives who worked extraordinary cases. This week, we follow a gifted but unlikely detective, the quiet-spoken and unassuming state trooper, Sergeant Glenn Flothy, as he follows a trail of killing. When a number of marginalized women go missing, hardly anyone seems to notice, not even when the bodies start turning up. It takes Sergeant Flothy to join the dots and piece together the clues that lead him to the door of a successful businessman. Could this respectable member of the community really be the cold-blooded predator killing sex workers? From Noiser, this is the story of Hunting the Hunter. And this is Detectives Don't Sleep. The 1980s in Alaska is a particularly grim and frightening time. In 1982, the murder rate is double that of the United States as a whole, making Alaska's homicide officers the most overworked in the nation. They feel the impact of the violence daily. The unsolved cases pile up on their desks, and whenever a missing person is reported, the fear at the back of everyone's mind is, will this turn out to be another murder victim? Of course, people go missing for all sorts of reasons, especially in a place like Alaska. Some simply get lost in its vast tracts of wilderness. Hikers, trappers, hunters, even the most experienced trackers can get caught out by a sudden blizzard, wander off the trail, and slip down an icy ravine, never to be seen again. There's always risks of bear attacks, too. But a woman found in a shallow grave together with a spent shell casing? That's a different story. It's not the landscape, it's not the wildlife, or the weather that killed her. It's another human being. The first notable killings of the 80s are centered around the city of Fairbanks, about 360 miles north of Anchorage. The bodies of five victims, all young women, are discovered between 1979 and 1981. It's clear that a serial killer is at large. Could the body found by the Kinnick River be another victim of the same killer? It's a tantalizing theory. It takes just over 6 hours to drive from Fairbanks to Anchorage along the park's highway. The route passes through some of Alaska's most rugged and spectacular terrain. A determined psychopath could certainly make the journey, both to escape the heat in their own hometown and to establish a new killing ground. But the detectives investigating the Kinnick River victim face a possibility even more frightening than a lone killer covering vast distances: the existence of two serial killers operating at the same time in different parts of the state.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
When the Kinnick River body is discovered, police in Anchorage have noticed an increase in the number of sex workers reported missing. Now, in Alaska, the disappearance of a few sex workers isn't usually a cause for alarm. It's viewed by some as little more than an occupational hazard. Sex work has been rampant in the state since 1968, when the discovery of oil brought about a huge influx of men to work oil fields. In the 70s, even more male workers flooded in to help with the construction of the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline. Most of these men were single, and there just weren't enough women to go around. The imbalance led to a boom in the sex industry. Women came from all over America to work the men who worked the oil. It was a transient and unstable lifestyle. The women drifted in and drifted out again, either because they'd grown tired of the work or made enough money to get out. Or maybe they got pregnant or were escaping an abusive pimp. Long story short, it wasn't unusual for sex workers to disappear without a trace. Generally, nobody gave it a second thought, not even the police, until the numbers rose above the baseline average, as they did in the early 1980s. Detective Maxine Farrell of the Anchorage Police Department began to notice a pattern among the missing women. According to witnesses she interviewed, a number of them had been due to meet a mystery man who offered them an exorbitant amount of money for a simple lunch date or to take a few harmless photographs. They went off for their innocent-seeming rendezvous and never came back. So when two bodies were found in quick succession in 1980, alarm bells started ringing. The first was discovered by construction workers digging near the Aklutna River. This victim has never been identified and to this day is known as Aklutna Annie. Not long after, a second victim was found in a gravel pit nearby. She'll eventually be identified as Joanne Messina, a former nurse. Could they be the victims of a serial killer? And could their killer be the mystery man who entices girls on dates with the promise of easy money? Maybe the Fairbanks perp on a killing trip. Despite her investigations into missing women, even Detective Farrell seems unwilling to think the unthinkable. At least, not publicly. We don't believe we have a mass murderer out there. Some psycho knocking off girls, she's reporting as saying. But we have to cover every possibility. Maybe this third body will make her change her mind. Sergeant Lyle Hawksman, homicide detective with the Alaska State Troopers, is assigned to lead the investigation into the Kinnick River homicide. In a departure from Detective Farrell's publicly declared position, Hawksman makes a carefully judged statement. We've got to keep those other girls in the back of our mind. In other words, it's time to consider the possibility that the disappearances and deaths are all connected. Hawksman authorizes a team of troopers to search the sandbanks of the Kinnick River for other victims. The labor-intensive operation eats up resources, but finds nothing. At the same time, Hawksman follows up any outstanding missing persons leads in the hope of identifying the latest victim. On September 27th, he gets a breakthrough. The Kinnick River body finally has a name. She's Sherry Moreau, a 24-year-old dancer. The circumstances of Sherry's disappearance, they're worryingly familiar. She was reported missing by her boyfriend in November 1981. Now, it didn't seem like she'd skipped town of her own free will, as she left everything she owned behind. And the day before she went missing, she told a friend that she was due to meet a man who had offered her $300 for a photo shoot. Yeah, this is huge. It's a definite link between the missing woman and an actual murder victim. Question now is, who is this shadowy individual? There are a number of clues found on or near Sherry's body that may help provide the answer. First, remember that shell casing investigators snagged when they were sifting the gravel from the burial site? According to initial tests, it's from a .223 caliber shell, which indicates a very specific kind of ammunition, the type used in a high-powered semi-automatic rifle or handgun. To Hogsman and his team, this suggests a serious weapons enthusiast, possibly someone ex-military or a survivalist, and alternatively, a competitive hunter. There's also, of course, another type of person who favors this kind of weapon. Deranged mass murderers. Interestingly, the presence of the shell casing argues against Sherry's death being connected to the first of the two bodies found in 1980, the woman known as Eklutna Annie. According to the evidence, Eklutna Annie died as the result of stab wounds. Sherry Moreau, the Kinnick River victim, was shot. One other vital piece of evidence was found on Sherry's body, an Ace-branded elastic bandage that had been wrapped around her head, maybe as a blindfold. Hogsman keeps this information out of the news. Maybe the killer still has the rest of the roll. Hearing about the discovery may prompt him to dispose of it, if he hasn't already. But the biggest clue will turn out to be something they don't find. When Hogsman interviews Sherry's boyfriend, he mentions a gold pendant in the shape of an arrowhead that he had given her for her birthday. He says she never took it off, and yet it wasn't found on Sherry's body. Maybe it got lost in the violent attack that killed her, or maybe her murderer took it as a memento. For now, it's a crucial detail that's logged in the file. But despite these discoveries, Hogsman is no closer to knowing who killed Sherry Moreau. On March 5th, 1983, police investigating the five women killed in Fairbanks close in on a U.S. Air Force technician called Thomas Richard Bunday. Bunday is now stationed in Wichita Falls, Texas. But in 1981, when the murders took place, he was serving on a base near Fairbanks. Bunday confesses to the murders of the five women. But in a strange oversight, no official warrant for his arrest has been issued, and he's released while the paperwork is completed. On March 15th, in the window created by this administrative error, he drives his motorcycle into oncoming traffic and is killed. There's little doubt that he killed himself to escape the consequences of his crimes. But the question is, could Bundy also be responsible for the murders of Eklutna Annie, Joanne Messina, and Sherry Moreau? It's theoretically possible, but there's nothing to put him in the Anchorage area at the relevant times. Sergeant Hawksman proceeds on the assumption that the killer he's hunting is still alive and still at large. On September 2nd, 1983, almost a whole year after Sherry Moreau's body was discovered, Hogsvin's assumption turns out to be correct when the remains of another female victim are found. The site of the discovery is the Kinnick River, very close to the sandbar where Sherry was buried. According to the medical evidence, the latest victim died in April 1983. About a month after Bundy's fatal accident, Bundy can't be the killer. Something else. Something that links this case to Sherry Moreau's murder even more than the location. The troopers searching the crime scene discover a .223 caliber shell casing nearby. The victim was killed by the same kind of high-powered semi-automatic rifle as Sherry Moreau. Troopers send the casings off to the FBI's forensic lab in Quantico. Soon they'll know whether the exact same weapon was used to kill both women. And if that's true, Bundy can't have been Sherry Moreau's killer either. And the troopers' worst fears will be confirmed. That there's a second serial killer prowling the Alaskan wilderness. It just so happens that when this second Kinnick River body is discovered, lead investigator Lyer Hogsvin is away on a much-needed vacation. The months of frustration and failure have taken their toll on him. The case passes to Sergeant Glenn Flothy, a detective with the Homicide Division of the Alaska State Troopers. Brown-haired and bespectacled, with a tall, gangly frame and an unassuming, almost geeky appearance, Flothy is an unlikely-looking police officer. His quiet demeanor is a million miles away from the usual abrasive bravado of the jaded cop, but his gaze is intense and determined. You get the impression that Flothy has seen it all, and it's affected him deeply. Somehow, it comes as no surprise that Flothy trained as a school teacher. In fact, he was all set to become one when, just out of interest, he took a community college course in police sciences. And that patient, schoolmasterly manner is still in evidence whenever he sits down with witnesses or suspects. He takes his time, tirelessly working a way to earn their trust or chip away their lies. Flothy's approach may be unconventional, but it works. Of the 17 homicides in his caseload, he solved all but one of them. The first thing Flothy does when he takes over the investigation is conduct a thorough review of all the missing women files. And nobody does thorough like Glenn Flothy. He goes back over every detail of these women's personal histories, cross-referencing timelines and the places where they were last seen. He studies their faces, blowing up 8x10 glossy photos that he places on the wall of his office, as well as investigating the murders of Sherry Moreau and the unidentified victim. Flothy reviews the two cold cases from 1980. The woman known as Eklutna Annie and Joanne Messina. Despite the difference in MO between Eklutna Annie and the most recent victims, Flothy is prepared to consider her as a potential victim of the same killer. She too was found in a shallow grave in a remote place by a river. He also believes there's a case for including Joanne Messina. Other police officers are skeptical. They're convinced they already know who killed Joanne, a suspect who failed a polygraph test when they were investigating the murder. They're unable to prosecute due to a lack of evidence, but as far as they're concerned, This man was Joanne's murderer. It doesn't look like he's a serial killer targeting random victims. He was linked specifically to Joanne Messina. Flothy's colleagues urge him to take Joanne off his list of victims, but with his usual quiet determination, you might even call it stubbornness, he keeps her picture on his wall. By day, Flothy immerses himself in the lives of the killer's typical victims, the sex workers of Anchorage. By night, on his own time, he reads up on serial killers. I guess it's the school teacher in him coming out. You know, always do your homework. In the 1980s, the actual term serial killer is still in its infancy, though the phenomenon itself has been recognized for decades. Even the police still use the term mass murderer and serial killer interchangeably. Though today, the first one specifically means someone who kills multiple victims at a single incident, while the second refers to a murderer who kills a number of victims over a period of time. Glenn Flothy is convinced he's dealing with a serial killer. As his wife drifts peacefully off to sleep beside him, he immerses himself in some of the most depraved acts that human beings have ever committed. Even for a seasoned homicide detective, the books make stomach-churning reading at times. But Flothy isn't studying them for their sensational shock value. He's reading them to learn. He wants to know what it is that makes these individuals tick. He needs to understand what he's up against. But he's also looking for patterns of behavior that he can match to his own cases. There may be clues in the books that can lead him to the Knik River Killer. So, Flothy reads long into the night. One book in particular fascinates him. An account of the crimes of Ted Bundy, the highly intelligent, handsome psychopath who confessed to killing 30 young women in the 70s. A university graduate who was active in Republican politics, Bundy came from a seemingly respectable middle-class background. Outwardly, he fit in. He was attractive, he was charming, and plausible. In the words of one writer who knew him personally, he was, quote, kind, solicitous, and empathetic, unquote. Inwardly, as Bundy himself put it, he was the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet. Could it be that Flothy is looking for somebody equally respectable? Maybe even a pillar of the community? Now, one incident in the Bundy story makes a big impression on Flothy. In November 1974, Bundy attempted to kidnap 18-year-old Carol Duranche in Murray, Utah. She managed to escape from his VW Beetle and was eventually able to ID her would-be abductor in a lineup. Her evidence was crucial in his conviction. It's the kind of break Flothy dreams of catching. On September 13th, 1983, 11 days after the second Knik River body was discovered, Flothy gets the break he's been hoping for. Flothy may not have been on the case long, but he's already familiarized himself with a stack of reports and files. He's casting the net wide, looking into every incident that could be remotely relevant, always with the hope of finding a witness who might have seen the killer in action, perhaps without even realizing it. There's a lot to go through. It's tedious, but essential work. Flothy doesn't let his concentration lapse for a moment. If he did, he might miss a vital lead. Now a file lands on Flothy's desk that has him sitting up and paying attention. So, it was 3 months earlier, in June of 1983, a young sex worker called Cindy Paulson reported being kidnapped and raped by a man who had offered her an exorbitant amount of money to go with him, which fits the profile of the mysterious figure enticing girls on dates. After assaulting her, The man drove her to an airfield outside Anchorage, where he kept a light aircraft, telling her that he was going to fly her out to a remote cabin he owned. He said it was because he wanted to spend more time with her, but Cindy knew what he really had in mind. While her kidnapper was distracted, she managed to make her escape, running barefoot and handcuffed onto a nearby freeway and flagging down a passing truck. "He's gonna kill me," she told the startled driver, who looked back and saw a man with a gun coming after them. The trucker slammed his foot on the gas and sped off. At Cindy's request, he took her to a nearby motel. She didn't want the police involved. She was a sex worker with a John. They weren't going to take her seriously. They might even end up charging her, but the trucker called him anyway. Sergeant Flothy reads a statement from the first officer to speak to Cindy Paulson, Greg Baker, from the Anchorage Police Department. When he found her at the motel, she was still in the handcuffs her kidnapper had put on her. She was also scared out of her wits. It was obvious that she'd endured a highly traumatic experience. Officer Baker released the cuffs and took Cindy back to the airfield, where she showed him her abductor's plane. He also spoke to a security guard who had taken down a license number for the car that the guy was driving. Flothy's excitement mounts as he reads on. For the first time, he feels like he's closing in on the killer. Officer Baker tracked down the owner of the car, who turned out to be a respectable Anchorage businessman, the proprietor of a bakery, in fact, by the name of Robert Hansen. When Officer Baker went to interview Hansen, he found some interesting things in his car. First, there was a roll of elastic bandage. What brand? Yep, you guessed it, Ace. The very same type of bandage that was wrapped around Sherry Morrow's head. He also spotted some cartridges, which to his highly trained eye, looked like they could be .223 caliber. There was also a Thompson Contender pistol, which comes with interchangeable barrels, one of which is a .223. And he also noticed a pair of latex surgical gloves, the type you might want to wear if you don't want to leave your fingerprints all over a crime scene. Of course, there might be a perfectly innocent explanation for why Hansen had each of these items in his car. But when you put them together, it looks kind of suspicious, don't you think? Officer Baker certainly thought so. He put Hansen in a lineup in front of Cindy Paulson. And sure enough, she picked him out as her kidnapper with no hesitation. Not a shadow of doubt in her mind. This was the guy who abducted her. But can you imagine how Sergeant Flothy feels reading this? They've got him, the Knik River killer. It has to be Hansen. And if Cindy Paulson hadn't managed to get away, she would have been another one of his victims. So surely the APD must have Hansen behind bars for what he did to Cindy. You'd have thought so. But it seems that they had a different opinion. Officers investigating the alleged kidnapping thought there were inconsistencies in Cindy Paulson's account. When she refused to take a polygraph test, they decided she was an unreliable witness. Not only that, Hansen produced not one, but two alibis. Two respectable members of the community swore that he was with them when the kidnapping was supposed to have happened. The first was a well-to-do manager of a big insurance company. The second was a boat builder. Both men would have stood up well before any jury. So, yep, Hansen was released without even being charged. Flothy can hardly believe what he's just read. There's no doubt in his mind Cindy Paulson was telling the truth. He's equally sure that Robert Hansen is the killer he's looking for. The witnesses who provided him with an alibi had to be lying. Flothy's disappointment turns to rage. Who knows how many women this Hansen guy has killed since the APD waved him on his way. And if Flossie doesn't take him off the street soon, the next murder will be on him. Next time on Detectives Don't Sleep. Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Glenn Flossie is convinced he knows who's killing marginalized women in the Anchorage area of Alaska. But can he prove it? When he looks into Robert Hansen's past, he finds a history of disturbing and violent behavior. But somehow, Hansen has managed to slip through the net time and time again. If Flossie is going to catch this killer, he needs all the help he can get. So he calls in expert profilers from the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Division to help him get inside his suspect's head. You can bet it's not a comfortable place to be. Join us as we look inside the mind of a serial killer in part 2 of Hunting the Hunter on Detectives Don't Sleep.